Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for November 6, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. This is mostly an Iraq and Empire show today. First, we'll in a few minutes, we'll speak with Richard Burkholder, who is with Gallup and supervised their polling of the residents of Baghdad. And we'll talk to him about not only what they found, but how you go about polling people in a city under occupation. And then at the bottom of the hour, speak with Ivo Dalder, interview actually recorded earlier this week. Dalder is a co-author of a book called America Unbound with James Lindsay about the Bush administration's foreign policy, a book recently published by the Brookings Institution's Press. And I will do my usual roundup of the economic news about 20 minutes from now, rather than at the top of the show, but I wanted to get to Richard Burkholder first. Before that, though, a couple of announcements. First, I'll be playing a little music by a band called The Dishes a little later in the show, and you will be able to see them on Saturday the 8th at the Knitting Factory in Manhattan. Check with the Knitting Factory for details, but that's Saturday, November 8th. And then also tonight at 7:30 p.m., a book party and forum for the book Sweatshop USA, The American Sweatshop in Historical and Global Perspective. Liza Featherstone, Rich Greenwald, Manny Ness, and others to be announced. An evening with contributors to this new book, Sweatshop USA, The American Sweatshop in Global and Historical Perspective. We've certainly seen a lot of scandals from Kathy Lee to the latest one of P. Diddy have brought the shocking and substandard conditions of factories to light, raising questions about the relationship between American consumer and the foreign laborer. And you can hear people talking about that and have some wine, too, at this book party tonight, 7:30 at the Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street. That's the Brecht Forum tonight. 7:30, 122 West 27th Street, and I'll repeat that at the end of the show as well. And now we're joined on the line by Richard Burkholder, who is the, I believe, the Director of International Polling at Gallup and supervised their polling of the residents of Baghdad at about, month or two ago. And, we'll talk to him about what he found and what his pollsters found. But first, I want to find out about how you go about polling people who have experienced dictatorship, war, sanctions, and now occupation. Welcome to WBAI, Richard Burkholder.
Hi, thanks for having me, Doug.
Thanks for joining us. Well, a lot of people I've talked to about the idea of polling in Baghdad in general, and specifically the Gallup poll, which got a lot of news coverage a little while ago, are pretty skeptical of any kind of results that they get, that you got out of it. Of course, most of the people I know hated the war and hate George Bush. I'm not exactly dealing with a representative cross-section of the American population. But how do you go about polling in a city that's suffered so much over the last 20 years?
Great question, Doug. You know, and there's a technical side of it, which I can deal with briefly, and then there's a human side of it that's, you know, that has to do with the social and political and even the military context of the interviewing at this point. Technical side is simple. We really do it, and I don't mean simple, but it's easy to describe. We're doing it basically the same way we did polling in the States up until when we shifted over to telephone interviewing about two decades ago, which means it's a pure probability sample of all the households in Baghdad, and then a random sample of adults within that household. So there it's a probability sample within the home. That said, you know, you can imagine one of the most burned out shells in town was what was the old Ministry of Planning. The census data are gone. We managed to find some files on track, but we had to reconstruct all of that, the sampling frame. But that's not even the hard part. I mean, we were in there, I guess, the first week of June, started going in there. And as you said, we just finally finished the interviewing over the period of late August and early September. But, you know, the technical side of it was a challenge in and of itself. We also had satellite imagery that you're able to buy that can show you density of population in areas. But really, every adult within Baghdad had an equal chance of being within the poll. But then there's the whole human side, and the question is, how do you do a poll of people in what's been a police state for 30 years, and how do you get good data? Correct? Can I shift to that?
Yes, that's the next question.
Okay, that's the big question. I had a couple things that are important. We had done a survey of the entire Islamic world that started soon after 9/11 that I coordinated. That ran from Morocco to Indonesia. 10,000 interviews, again, nationwide samples. This is a Baghdad, this is a metro sample, but pure probability samples. And one of the things I really learned two things, I think, that were useful in that. One is to work at all, it has to have a local look to it. So the poll that we've done in Baghdad doesn't have any kind, it doesn't come across in any sense as a poll by Americans or for an American audience or for American media. That would have been a disaster.
Yeah, let me pursue that a second.
Yeah.
Was there any risk that you were perceived as representatives of an occupying power and people wouldn't give you a straight answer?
Had we given any intimation that this was for an American group, or were there Americans involved directly present at the interviewing, absolutely, that would have been a problem. That would have contaminated the whole structure. And even in a and given, you know, even though this was an Iraqi-to-Iraqi poll with our team, our supervising team, which are Lebanese nationals, Syrian nationals, and so on, who helped me with the first survey, I was there personally from early July on. There's still a problem getting people to open up to some extent. But one of the things, again, that we learned on the first Islam poll is if they get a sense from the interview and from the supervisor and for the content itself that there really aren't any right or wrong answers, and you really are trying to look at how the world looks to them. And by that, and part of that has to do with how you structure the questionnaire, open-ended questions, a lot of sort of less intrusive questions at the beginning about what values they think are important, what do they want to teach their children, what sorts of books do they read, that kind of thing. Then what you find, and one of the biggest plaints or pleadings in the first survey that we did across the whole Islamic world was, geez, what an interesting question. Nobody ever asked my opinion on that before. Everybody wants to talk to our governments. Everyone wants to talk to our elites and our religious leaders, but, you know, my view doesn't matter. So we had... Ultimately, we had a problem, not a problem, but we were graced by effectively over-cooperation. We had only 3% of the people that we tried to contact refused to do it. The interviews went an average of 70 minutes long, and we pre-tested at basically a 50-minute interview. The open ends went on, you know, interminably, and then people also spent a time trying to explain to us why they had given the answers they gave to closed-ended questions. Let me tell you why I said that. We had people... Once we convinced them that the results were going to be in the media there and so on, we had people following us around saying, you have to hear my sister's story. You have to hear what I've been through, trying to opt into the poll. So you certainly don't have a burnout rate of non-response bias here. So that was really the context. It's really meeting people where they are and treating them with respect and listening to their side of things.
And the polling was done by Iraqis?
Yes, it was done by Iraqis. We originally had a plan to bring in the team that had done our field work in Jordan on the Islam poll from Amman overland. What we were told, there were folks who knew the city well, who had been doing who knew the various neighborhoods, and who had been doing a consumer purchasing tracking thing, even before the invasion, who had subsequently been vetted. They're working for the State Statistical Office. We got to hire our sort of cherry-pick people from those teams, as well as our own folks who knew the city well. And they, you know, are the real heroes, kind of field heroes in this, are a fellow named Jihad Faradin out of the Dubai office of our sister company, and Bassam Khalifa, who we spent weeks briefing these people in pre-testing. And I can show you photographs of the teams of, you know, male and female, different types of headgear for different types of areas. But it's we were in what was Saddam City with several hundred interviews there, 122 different locations around Baghdad.
And I read in some of the copy on your website that there was not much of a problem with men not wanting to be interviewed by women and vice versa.
No, that's really, you know, traditionally in Baghdad, and that is something we encountered in the earlier poll, particularly in rural parts of places like Lebanon and certainly in Saudi Arabia, where it's just prohibited, really. You have separate teams explicitly. And in several of the more conservative areas of some of those states, but not so much in Baghdad. We could do that if they requested. But, you know, cooperation is one thing. The question is, what is the content, the reliability of the content? What we found, and I think it's encouraging, is that they give really mixed ratings and that there's no kind of politically correct response that they give. For instance,
well, one more question before we get into the findings. Do you have any sense of how representative the Baghdad population is of the rest of the country?
You know, we don't pretend that it represents anything other than the metro area of Baghdad, which is a quarter of the population of the country. But it is to Iraq what, let's say, London is to Britain or Paris to France. It's a very it's the nerve center, of, obviously, of government and society. Ironically, we chose Baghdad as an area that was fairly geographically compact, thinking early on that that would, you know, from a security standpoint, be the most trackable and easy to deal with. And of course, it didn't work out that way. But what I was going to say is that the substance of the results that we get tend to indicate that they give credit where credit's due and blame and fault where fault is due. I'll give you some examples. I mean, U.S., you know, you talked about the characteristics of your audience. The U.S. As a whole gets quite negative ratings. Bush gets very negative ratings. Bremer, the CPA administrator, is actually fairly positive.
Yeah, that was an interesting contradiction because people, you know, very skeptical about U.S. motives. Also, the reasons for the invasion.
Right.
Number one, to rob Iraq's oil.
Right.
43% said that.
Or to relieve Hussein, you know, to oust Hussein for our own reasons, or to redraw the map of the Middle East along Israeli and U.S. interest lines. And so
people, and Tony Blair and George Bush are not popular figures.
Exactly. Bremer's higher popular because he speaks to the Iraqi people on a weekly address, and he has a way of coming across as internalizing their priorities and caring about the things that they care about. So he's, I guess, given some personal credit for that, regardless of... He gets better ratings than the CPA itself does. Okay, the Coalition Provisional Authority, you know, 62% of the folks we talked to said that they have done a worse job than they would have expected at the outset. However, 50% say they were doing a better job than they had been doing 2 months previously. The Iraqi Governing Council is seen as a step in the right direction, gets favorable marks, but... You know, 75% of the people that we interviewed said they think its policies are mostly dictated by the CPA. So it's across the board.
Yeah, I should say I'm speaking with Richard Burkholder, who's the director of international polling for Gallup about the organization's survey of Baghdad's public opinion. How do you reconcile this? You know, this idea that the CPA, you know, people have kind of a positive image of it, but they think it's a puppet of the United States. So,
you mean the Iraqi Governing Council?
The Governing Council, the Sorry, yeah.
You know, they see any move towards putting an Iraqi face on this whole project as a positive development. I'll give you another example with regard to security. If you ask them what they think would happen if the U.S. if the coalition troops were to be withdrawn fairly soon over the next few months, 85% of them say there would be chaos. You know, there would be anarchy. So given where the ball lies right now and where one has to play it right now, they don't want to see that happen. But if you ask them in an open-ended question, what should the coalition do or what should be done to improve security, overwhelmingly they say build up an Iraqi police force, build up courts here, get the police, you know, in numbers and in authority and in an ability to arrest and have people actually stay in jail. None of the answers that you get in the open end have to do with increasing coalition patrols or troop patrols. It all has to do with putting a local face on the where the problem lies at this point.
Now, what about the question of retaining a U.S.-British force with, you know, some Poles and miscellaneous other folks thrown in versus a truly international force,
you know,
under the U.N.?
We did ask a question about whether they'd like to see an international police force, and they said overwhelmingly they would. They also wanted to see the reconstruction process internationalized in terms of assistance from other countries. So, you know, clearly, any help they can get. The fact that, I guess to say it in a nutshell, they feel like we did that they are the beneficiaries in some sense of us doing the right thing for the wrong reason. You know, but the project isn't finished yet, and it's brought with it a lot of short-term pain for them. You know, I think almost half of them said that they were actually worse off when we interviewed them in late August and early September, that their lives were actually worse off than they were before the war, and only a third said they were already better. But if you ask them where are they going to be 5 years from now, they're optimistic. And nearly two-thirds, 62%, said anything they've gone through since the invasion was worth it because Hussein was ousted. So I think it's a fairly, you know, detailed and subtle kind of analysis they give you.
And you used neighborhoods as kind of a proxy for social class.
Yeah, well, we do ask their income. We do ask their education. But you can tell a lot about you know, certain, if you take an area like Saddam City, which is now Sadr City, which is just really a huge slum that was a Shia slum that was at the bottom of the barrel in terms of any kind of resources and repression under the Hussein regime. Yes, you know, very poor. And ironically, at the time of our interviewing, the least dismissive of the coalition action, they had lost the least in the short term. They were the most optimistic for the future. You get more mixed ratings, the more people had to lose. The more, you know, in a place like Saddam City, they didn't have clean water to start with. You know, electricity was a problem anyway, so they haven't lost anything in the process.
You also have a question about the images of various countries. Who's liked and who's not?
Yeah. France and, to a certain extent, Germany and Russia, the three countries that were vocal in the Security Council, vocal opponents of the coalition invasion, get far higher marks than the U.S. does and then Britain did. UN gets pretty high marks as well, although UN is a kind of a mixed thing because they were also seen as the conduit through which the sanctions occurred for the last 12 years.
Yeah, did you ask questions about the sanctions?
Not the sanctions as such. We only get that indirectly through the appraisal of the UN.
You also ask, people thought the sacrifices were worth it,
right,
of getting rid of Saddam. What kind of answers did you get there?
Yeah, as I said, 62% said they thought that they really were worth it. And now you get to an area, I don't remember the precise percentage, but an area like what was Saddam City, it's up in the low 80s, I think, where some of the really, you know, the areas like Kark, which has Mansour district, which was government employees and so on, then it split 50-50. They lost more. You have more government after apparatchiks and so on in that area. But overall, across the board, if you do the whole population, which is 6.4 million people, that's a quarter of the population of the whole country. Yes, 62% said it was worth it.
And you also asked how long should the occupying forces stay. What kind of responses?
Well, we actually asked what would happen if they left early, and that's where you get this negative concern that, you know, that 85% saying there would be chaos. So they may not have invited them in. They might have liked to have seen this, the regime ousted in other ways. But it's very clear throughout the data that security is the overwhelming concern. And we have, like, you know, large majorities who tell us that even within the past 4 weeks, there were times when they were afraid to go outside of their house during the day because of security reasons. It's not just attacks on troops or even or now policemen who are strategic targets of the opposition at this point. It's street crime. It's kidnapping, carjackings in the wealthier areas, rape in certain areas. The security has been by far the biggest problem that they've had to deal with.
And, of course, the water and electricity were problematic as well.
Exactly. Even medical care to a certain extent early on, even access, not for extended time access to food, but, you know, we measured all of those things and we asked, were they a problem at all since the invasion? Were they a problem within the past 4 weeks? And we also asked, were they a problem, you know, before the invasion?
And what about questions about the longer term? What kind of government they would like to see?
Ah, great question. We gave them about seven options, which are a little complicated to describe. But basically, the one that comes up, the one that's best, that is most likely to be chosen as their preferred option, 39% choose it, is a multi-party parliamentary system along sort of Western or North American lines. That gets 39% as a choice. 29%, the second most popular choice, is a system based on the Islamic concept of shura, which is a concept of consultation, sort of like the lawyer jirga in Afghanistan. So that tends to get mentioned more by the people with less education, but it does imply an interest in consultation and accountability to the public. The other options that are chosen, which would be, that are put before them, which would be a more theocratic state along Iranian lines or a state at one extreme along the lines of the Taliban in Afghanistan get virtually no mention. I think the Iranian option is maybe 10%. The other option is a constitutional monarchy, which is what they had before the Ba'athist takeover, gets little support. Something along Saudi lines gets little support. So it's really some form of public accountability. And they may not be able to express that in sort of political science 101 terms, but it's clear that's what they want. We also asked, and I just finished a piece on this that'll be on our website next Tuesday, about kind of Bill of Rights freedoms, support for freedom of speech. Should the Constitution guarantee freedom of speech? Should it guarantee freedom of religion or freedom of assembly? Overwhelmingly, they say yes to freedom of speech. Very high numbers, high 80s, freedom of religion, somewhat less to freedom of assembly. But clearly they want what we would regard as a popularly accountable government.
And how do people feel about attacks on the occupying forces?
Oh, really interesting question. We asked about the moral acceptability of such attacks. We found about 1 in 5, I think, that said that those attacks could be sometimes justified. It runs on a scale from never justified, sometimes justified, to often justified, and always justified. And about another third who were, about a third in total, in Baghdad, who said that there were certain conditions under which they could justify them. You know, they were neutral on them. But we have about 60% who said, no, they really aren't morally admissible. It depends on how you look at those numbers, though. To be honest, Doug, I mean, is that two-thirds full, or is that 400,000 people who are saying, yeah, you know, the attacks on the coalition forces are something that I support strongly?
Well, if you have that large a minority with hundreds of thousands of tons of weapons hanging around, I guess they can produce a lot of mayhem.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a lightly armed place.
And at least just judging from some of the reports of attitudes outside of Baghdad, you know, when that helicopter was down the other day, there were farmers in the nearby field saying the Americans are pigs and they deserve this.
Yeah, that was Fallujah, which is probably right, you know, if you were to go to sort of ground zero of the most vehement resistance to and the most pro-Ba'athist region of the country, that would be it.
And Iraq is under Saddam, but even earlier, I believe, was historically kind of a secular place.
Right.
And women had considerable freedoms compared to the rest of the region. What are attitudes about the future of women?
Yeah, great question, and to me a little bit troubling. I mean, we asked a question about whether or not whether women should have play the same roles and have the same levels of public freedoms as they had in the past, or a greater level or a lesser level, and we find a large number are now saying, no, they should adopt more conservative roles. Part of this is a kind of, and we wrote an analytical piece on this, part of this is a kind of regression to norms of religiosity and of conservatism. You can't, in one breath in the interview, say, yes, religion's important to me, these values are important, and then kind of deny and kind of answer that question easily in the other direction. But that I think that does wait, you know, beg to be seen. That's a little bit troublesome to me to see a majority now saying, well, perhaps they should adopt somewhat more conservative roles in public.
I imagine this was a pretty expensive and complicated undertaking. Are you going to be going back anytime soon?
Yeah, we are. And I was just talking with my CEO a little while ago, Doug. We did this on our own nickel, and we'll recoup some of it through our kind of premium service that we have on our website, where some of the articles are available on a subscription basis. But nowhere near all of it. It's really a case. We're privately employee owned and small. And I guess any polling firm in some sense is small. The CEO really came to me in March and said, we just have to measure this, and we have to do it right, as we did on the Islam poll, and we have to be the first people to do it. So my mandate now is to build this out to a nationwide project, and also to track. That's a very important thing that we captured one point in time, Doug, and it's been almost 6 weeks since we finished the field work, and it's a very fluid situation. So we'll be doing that, and we'll recoup some of those costs, but we have other areas that'll cover that for us.
And any calls from the White House for a briefing?
Well, not so much for a briefing. I think everybody sees our stuff on the website, and hopefully they pay attention to it, and I would actually rather they pay more rather than less attention to it. And that's true of our Islam poll as well. I did quite a few briefings to various political groups in Washington at their request on the Islam poll, and often wish they would have paid closer attention to it.
All right, well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Doug.
Richard Burkholder, who is the Director of International Polling for Gallup, talking about that organization's polls of the people of Baghdad. And before I get to the interview with Ivo Dalder, just some words about the economic news. It's been a while since I've been on here. And since I've been here last, the U.S. economy does show some signs of recovering. On October 30th, it was announced that gross domestic product grew by a very rapid rate of 7.2% in the third quarter of this year, very far above expectations, and not off the charts in terms of strength, but a pretty strong result. And it's very interesting that well, a lot of people are very enthusiastic about this number, but in fact, it was also a quarter in which the U.S. economy lost 41,000 jobs. So we have 7.2% growth rate at the same time we're losing jobs, and That's not a very happy situation. And this morning it was reported that productivity was up in that same quarter by a little over 8% at an annual rate. And it's not hard to do the math. If the employment is shrinking and output is growing, then productivity is up by definition. And it makes you, you know, productivity is usually taken as a great thing. Strong growth in productivity is thought to be very virtuous. But if it means that people are not getting jobs, that people were producing lots of stuff with fewer people, well, that the social payoff of that is kind of hard to determine. And it's quite unlikely that we'll see anything like this continuing. I don't think you can continue to shed jobs and have growth rates like that in the future. Some other news, the Institute for Supply Management, which polls purchasing managers at corporations, purchasing managers, the people who buy things, so they're very sensitive to the state of business. And these polls have proven a very sensitive indicator of what's going on in the economy. A poll of the manufacturing sector showed that in October, their index rose to 57. Whenever it's above 50, the manufacturing sector is expanding. Below 50, it's contracting. And that continues a pattern of increases that started last May. So we've had one down month, but four or five out of the last 6 months have been up months. So signs of manufacturing revival. But also there, the employment section of that indicator showed a shrinkage. So we're still, even though factories seem to be producing more stuff, they're doing so with fewer people. The ISM, Institute for Supply Management, also about 6 years ago, the manufacturing poll goes back, survey rather, goes back about almost 50 years. But the non-manufacturing or the service sector is just a new thing. It's been leaving around 6 years, so we don't really know what its track record is like. But it showed even stronger results, right? 64.7, well above the 50 dividing line between expansion and contraction. And there, the employment number went firmly above 50 for the first time in a long time. It had been flirting with that 50 level for some time, but now we're showing pretty solid gains in employment, at least according to that poll in the or survey in the service sector. So some signs of strengthening economy and some signs of a turnaround in the job market, but we're not quite there yet. And as I said here many times, one of the things that's kept the U.S. economy going over the last couple of years with the job market so weak has been that people have been borrowing heavily against the value of their appreciated home equity, loans and second mortgages and things like that. Or when they refinance their mortgages at a lower interest rate, they've been taking some cash out in the process. That really kept consumption going over the last few years, but that trend now seems to be running out of steam. Really since late August, the number that index peaked in June and fell for most of the summer and has been bobbing around kind of flat for the last several months. So we're not going to have that source of cash keeping the economy going. We're going to need some sign of revival in the job market. And this morning, there was one of those signs. The figure for the number of people filing for first-time unemployment claims, that is, they lose their job, head to the unemployment office, and file for benefits. Very sensitive indicator of what's going on in the labor market, and released only several days after the end of the week. So it's a very not only sensitive but very timely. That took a very, very sharp drop off 43,000 and is now below the level that is thought to represent the division between an expanding job market and a contracting job market. Now, these weekly numbers are very volatile and subject to very strange seasonal adjustment quirks, so it wouldn't make too much out of a single week. But if this trend continues, then that will be a good sign that the job market is turning around. We will get tomorrow morning at 8:30 the employment report for October, which will tell us what happened to the unemployment rate, to the number of people on the job as well. That the employment report consists of two surveys, one of households. About 60,000 households every month are polled to ask whether they're working and at what and how long and all kinds of questions like that, lots of demographic questions as well. And there's another poll of or survey, rather, of employers. About 300,000 employers are also surveyed, a very large and complicated survey, and we'll get the results of that tomorrow morning. It's likely that the U.S. economy added Well, last month we added 57,000 jobs. It's likely we add a bit more than that in October. Certainly, it's nice to see the number above zero, but it's not what we would be seeing in a normal month. In a normal average month, we should be adding about 220,000 jobs. In an economic recovery, which usually snaps back very quickly after a recession, we'd be seeing 300,000 or 400,000 increases. We're not likely to see anything like that. So the recovery in the job market is slow and weak and still very tentative. Maybe picking up a little steam, but it's got a long way to go, and it's impossible to maintain any kind of economic recovery for very long if the job market doesn't kick in. But employers have been very, very reluctant to hire people, and they still show not too many signs of changing their mind there. So some holiday hiring probably going on at retailers and some other service hiring going on. Factories probably still not hiring people. So if things pick up, then the recovery can sustain itself. But we're not there yet. So I'll have some comments on what we learn tomorrow, well, next week. And let's take a little break and listen to this song from The Dishes. An excerpt from the song Hole in Your Head from the new album Three by the Chicago-based band Three Women, One Man, The Dishes, and in that wonderful garage punk tradition that some of us love so much. And you can see them at the Knitting Factory on Saturday night. And now, an interview I recorded earlier. Oh, I should say, please, remember, we're still doing a little fundraising here. You should, free form radio, freedom of speech doesn't come for free. We need you to pledge. We need you to call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Times are tough everywhere, and we need your help to get through these tough times. 212-209-2950. If you're listening on the web, please go over to WBAI.org, or if you're listening even over the air, you can do the same thing. 212-209-2950 or WBAI.org. Make your pledge. Keep us going and keep the wolf from the door, because the wolf is very hungry and very menacing. 212-209-2950. Please give us a call. And you can, anytime up to 6, there will be volunteers there to take your pledge. And, of course, the web is tireless and will accept your pledge at any time of the day or night at WBAI.org. And now, an interview I recorded earlier. Oh, WBAI is the radio station, 99.5 FM New York. My name is Doug Henwood, the show Behind the News. And an interview I recorded earlier this week with Ivo Dalder, who is the co-author, along with James Lindsay, of a book called America Unbound, an investigation of the Bush foreign policy. Dalder is a former Clinton administration official who is now at the Brookings Institution, and Brookings also published the book, Ivo Dalder. You've written that correctly, that a lot of intellectuals and liberals have emphasized how little Bush knows, but you also write about him as a man who is very sure of his convictions and will take action, even though he's not a very reflective person. So that sounds like the definition of a fanatic. Is that what you're trying to get after?
No. Basically, what we're trying to get after is to solve the observation that, on the one hand, this clearly is a man who
doesn't have a wide range knowledge about foreign policy. During the campaign, you remember there was that infamous TV interview when he was asked the names of the presidents of Taiwan and India and Pakistan, and I believe it was Chechnya, and he didn't really know any of them, and that sort of stuck. The image of a man who really didn't know, wasn't world-wise, was a foreign policy lightweight. And yet, you have seen a president who has been decisive, bold in many ways in his leadership, and convinced about the rightness of his cause. How was one to square that circle? One way in which people have squared it is to say that, in fact, Bush is a puppet. He's been run by other people, whether it's the Vice President Dick Cheney or the Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld. Another way, and I think a more accurate way to say, is this is a man with strong beliefs, strong convictions about how the world works, and he has acted upon those convictions when in those circumstances. Where the world seemed to accord to his point of view, which has principally been in cases where we have been threatened or attacked by terrorists or by rogue states, which seems to be the main thrust of his foreign policy. Much of the rest of the world doesn't interest or bother him very much, and he hasn't had the kind of decisive leadership that one would expect from someone who knows more.
Were these instincts sleeping before September 11th in dormancy, or is that what brought them out, or did you think that even had we not suffered those attacks that we would have seen something like this kind of foreign policy?
You saw part of this foreign policy already beforehand in the unilateralism in which in the first 8 months he bestrode the world stage, where he walked out of Kyoto, he walked out of the ABM treaty, or he said he was going to walk out of it, and did a variety of other highly unilateralist foreign policy moves. But foreign policy clearly was not the most important thing for Bush when he became president. He didn't run on foreign policy, and he didn't act on foreign policy much in the first 8 months. What September 11 did is exactly as you say. It released the energy and the ideas that were there beforehand. One way to look at it is Bush had the means and motives for the revolution that he led. What 9/11 did is he gave it the opportunity to actually act upon those means and motives, and he's done so with a conviction and a strength that that has surprised many.
You've said that what he's trying to do is defend the United States against terrorist attack or rogue states, but also some of his advisors have very ambitious plans to remake the Middle East, to transform the whole region, you know, into some kind of version of liberal democracy, if that's conceivable. Which is it? Is it defensive, or is it really revolutionary and transformative?
I think in terms of the Middle East, it is there are two strands of thinking within his administration. Those who believe that it is fundamentally about defending the United States against the threats that are out there, and those who believe that the only way the United States can truly be secure is if the rest of the world is remade in America's image, starting in this case with the Middle East. Both of those strands exist within his administration. Our sense, as we write in America Unbound, is that Bush, while idealistically predisposed, as indeed most presidents have been in the past, to the second view, is only willing to exert and use American power in support of the first view, in support of the destructive view, the notion that you have to destroy the threats that arise, and then in so doing provide the opportunity for others in the region to use the liberty thus granted, for example, and make the wise choices themselves. But it is up to them, not up to the United States, to fundamentally create the conditions that allows democracy to foster. It is up to the United States to deal with the threats and the obstacles that prevent people from being free. But once they are free, it is really up to them to make sure they use their freedom wisely, not to the United States.
I think before the Bush administration, the United States certainly was willing to do things unilaterally. This is not always a country that proceeded according to collegiality and consultation. But there was a sense that there was supposed to be some dedication to multilateralism. Bush's own father, for example, refused to prosecute the war any further against Iraq because it would have broken the coalition and violated with the principles of post-Cold War order he was trying to create. And also, you know, American foreign policy has also tried to emphasize a kind of moral authority and a belief in democracy. This looks more like naked self-interest and power politics. Is this really as radical a departure as it seems?
Well, it's radical and indeed what we would argue revolutionary in the sense that whereas previous presidents, notably his father, but in fact even Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon and, of course, John F. Kennedy and Bill Clinton and others, have believed that the way you maintain and indeed extend and perpetuate America's privileged position is by working with others and in partnership, working through international institutions and on the basis of agreed norms and rules, that the way you promote America's interest is to do it in a multilateral framework, not to subordinate American interests to that framework, but to use those frameworks and the partnerships and the alliances that exist as a means to extend American power. What's revolutionary is that this president does not look at alliances or international organizations or indeed even international law in many instances as a means to perpetuate American power, but as obstacles, as constraints on the ability of the United States to act in the way it deems best. And in that sense, it is true that what is really going on is a fundamental shift in the way the United States has revolutionized American power away from the notion that one needs to work with other countries to the concept of doing it by herself because we have the power to do so. And in some ways, what is unique today is how powerful the United States is compared to other periods in American history relative to others. We, in fact, now can do very much what we would like to do, whereas previously we were not in a position to act as such.
But we're also very heavily dependent upon foreigners buying our treasury bonds and funding a lot of these foreign adventures. Do you think that the Bush administration really thinks about any of these sorts of economic constraints on the freedom of American action?
No, and I think the Achilles heel, in fact, the fundamental flaw in this foreign policy is the notion that we can do most of the things we want by ourselves just because we are the most powerful country in the world. In fact, in an era of globalization in which much of what happens in the United States is affected by what happens abroad. After all, it was people who were trained in terrorist camps in Afghanistan, who were born and raised in places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, who grew up and became more fanatical in places like Hamburg, and learn how to fly airplanes in places like Phoenix and Arizona and in Florida that attacked us on September 11th. And in the age that we live, in an age of globalization, what we call the age of global politics, any basic challenge and any basic opportunity the United States faces, whether it's dealing with terrorism, whether it's dealing with weapons of mass destruction, the spread of infectious diseases, climate change, making sure that we enhance our own prosperity, requires ultimately even a country as strong as the United States to work with others, to cooperate with other institutions and with other countries in order to meet those challenges together, because alone, even the United States cannot meet the challenges that are out there or exploit the opportunities that present themselves in this age. And the flaw in this foreign policy is the belief that just because we're powerful, we're somehow omnipotent. In fact, we're not. In fact, in this world in which most of the things happen across borders, it is essential that we find ways to cooperate with those people in order to achieve our objectives.
And do you think that the Bush administration is having any second thoughts along the lines you just described?
I don't see any evidence of it. I think what we see is tactical flexibility, a willingness to exploit cooperation and multilateral engagement with other countries, as indeed we going back to the UN in order with regard to Iraq and dealing with a bunch of regional allies in terms of North Korea. But those are tactical adjustments, not a strategic realignment. Take Iraq. We do have a unanimous Security Council resolution passed 2 weeks ago, but we have no more troops and no more money than we otherwise would have gotten, in part because we insisted on maintaining control of the occupation. Or in North Korea, where we are engaged in the six-party talks with the North Koreans and to deal with the nuclear threat, and yet are not willing to engage in a serious negotiation designed to meet the concerns of the North Koreans and indeed designed to find a peaceful solution to the crisis that is there. So what I see is, yes, in form, we are willing to adhere to the multilateralist creed in the hope that others would then support us, but in substance, the essence of the unilateral revolutionary strategy that this administration has embarked upon remains.
I'm speaking with Ivo Dalder, co-author with James Lindsay of America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy, just published by Brookings. I can't remember whether it was Wolfowitz or Pearl who, before the war started, imagined that it would be a cakewalk. Do you think they were taken by surprise at how difficult it's turned out to be?
Yeah, I think I think it actually was Ken Edelman who mentioned what is a cakewalk, also part of the Defense Policy Board. But there was a general view that this would be easy. And, in fact, it was relatively easy. Saddam was ousted in less than 21 days. From the beginning to the end of the war, of that phase of the conflict. What they underestimated was the difficulty of rebuilding societies, the difficulty of sustaining momentum. They basically assumed that once the top layer of Iraqi society had been removed, the Ba'athist leadership and Saddam Hussein, that the remainder of society would quickly turn to supporting the United States, its foreign policy and domestic political objectives, and be able to act. What they didn't understand, strangely enough, for people who are in general good historians, is that if you take away the top layer in a totalitarian society, the entire society collapsed, which is exactly what happened. Law and order was removed, hence the looting. The infrastructure had been obliterated by 35 years of bad management, and Iraq, rather than being a live society that would quickly get back on its feet, turned out to be a nothing short of a failed state once you had taken the totalitarian leadership away. So what you clearly had was a complete misunderstanding of what we were confronting in Iraq, and in many ways an overestimation of American power to do anything about it, and an underestimation of the problems we faced.
There are some people who say that the public pretext for the war were really just a cover for a lust for Iraqi oil. Do you think what do you think of that kind of explanation? Were there really deeply economic motives for the war, or was it more as the president and the people around him have explained?
Yeah, I don't buy the notion that this was about war about oil. If so, it was an extraordinarily expensive exposition. We've spent about to spend in 18 months $150-some billion on this war, which is a lot of money to maintain a secure oil supply, which was pretty secure even before that. I really think this was about what the president thought it was about, which is that after 9/11, the risks of living with a dictator like Saddam Hussein, who I think we did believe had an active chemical and biological weapons program and was pursuing nuclear weapons, that risk was just judged to be too great. It was acceptable prior to 9/11, which is why I think that if there had been no terrorist attack, we also wouldn't have had any war. But after 9/11, the president clearly concluded, without being prodded by the neocons, as often made the case, he concluded that risk that Saddam and his supposed WMD programs posed was now no longer acceptable. What changed was the risk calculation. I don't think what changed was a sense of economic opportunism.
Before the end of the war, there was a lot of ambitious talk about where next. Was it going to be Syria? Was it going to be Iran? What about those plans now? Have those been shelved, or do they still have ambitions to move on from Baghdad?
Well, I think there clearly is a split within the administration between those who would like to move on to the next member of the Axis of Evil, or at least the next threat that is out there, be it Syria or Iran or indeed North Korea, and those who realize that this particular incursion in Iraq was more difficult than we had thought, that we are more bogged down and tied down in Iraq than we had thought, that the political consensus and support for another incursion, another war, is just not there at the moment, particularly if you can't make the threat sufficiently real, a prospect that is lessened by the fact that we haven't found any weapons of mass destruction or indeed any substantiation of the many claims that the administration had prior to the war about the threat that Iraq posed in this area, that therefore the stark reality is that this revolution may well have petered out in the sands of Iran, because we can't push it any further. The notion that we're now going to go after Syria or Iran, frankly, is something that that is far removed from the reality, because there is no political support, there's frankly no military capability, and the costs of doing so are becoming so tremendous, both in our diplomatic standing in the world and economically or at home, that the prospect of turning in that direction, though much stronger at the beginning of the war, now seem to be close to zero.
Do you think they've got any plans up their sleeve for how to handle Iraq now? It's just an utter mess, and looks like it could be an utter mess for many, many years. They're going to, well, you've described the president also as a pragmatist, even if he is a revolutionary. Is he likely to swallow his pride and take a more multilateral approach, or are they just going to soldier on in the current fashion?
I think there's a third option, which is to reduce the footprint and presence and vulnerability of the United States inside Iraq. And what I think is going to happen is that we will start moving towards an Afghanistan model for Iraq, by which I mean rather than waiting for a new constitution and elections before to handing tea, that we will move within the next 3 to 6 months to endorsing a provisional government in Iraq, which would be fully sovereign, that the coalition provisional authority, the American occupation authorities, would remain in support of that government, that much of the security functions in Iraq, both in the streets of Baghdad and on the borders and in infrastructure, will be handed over to the Iraqis themselves, supported by an international force, perhaps led not by us but by the Brits, and that our military presence would be basically smaller, 50, 60,000 people placed in bases in the desert who would conduct the occasional counterinsurgency raids, which so far have not been very costly in American lives, but we would not be doing the patrolling and the large-scale presence in the Sunni triangle that so far has resulted in the numerous casualties that we have seen. So that one would hope that the expectation would be that while the ambition for Iraq would be scaled down significantly to basically an early handover of power from the United States to the Iraqis themselves, the issue itself would no longer be as dominant in the headlines as it is today and quickly recede to page 825 in the newspapers.
The example of Afghanistan is not terribly inspiring. The joke is that Karzai is the mayor of Kabul, and we hear the Taliban are on the rise again in the hinterlands. In Iraq now, even greater levels of chaos, of potential chaos are possible. But it's also a country with a lot of oil. So is there any risk of that the United States is actually creating the very breeding ground for terrorism that it was ostensibly aiming to wipe out?
Yeah, there's a large risk of that happening. The question is whether that risk becomes sufficiently apparent before we turn the American people go to the ballot box next year in November. But clearly, this is a risk. It's a risk that we have exposed ourselves to in Afghanistan itself, which is rapidly returning to the kind of situation that existed prior to 9/11, with the exception that there is no Taliban government fully supporting the terrorist infrastructure. But there doesn't have to be a supportive government for that infrastructure to thrive, and clearly it's thriving in Iraq. They're the ones who are conducting the kinds of bombings that we saw a week ago against the four police stations and the Red Cross, which we've seen against the UN, which can continue to operate in precisely such a fashion. And yes, of course, one of the real dangers of having conducted this war in the manner that we have is that far from improving the security of the United States by eliminating a direct threat to our security, we may well have created a situation in which chaos thrives and within which terrorism multiplies rather than is thrown asunder.
So are you suggesting that the administration is cynical enough to, because of the basic electoral algebra, willing to create a very dangerous place in Iraq just for the interest of getting themselves reelected?
I'll put it slightly differently, which is to say that this is already a very dangerous place, and it's only getting more and more dangerous. And the question is, are we going to pursue a course which insists that the outcome must be a democratic Iraq, which some in this administration keeps on hampering away, at the cost even of large numbers of casualties and great numbers of troops remaining stuck in Iraq at extraordinary costs. or is this administration capable of ratcheting down its objectives for Iraq and basically saying what we will do is continue to go after the terrorists that are there and the insurgent and conduct a major counterinsurgency campaign, which presumably they would hope to win, and at the same time lower the profile of Iraq for electoral reasons. It may not, in fact, be a bad strategy to abandon the ambitious goal for the democratization of Iraq, particularly since the way we've gone about it in the past 6 months may, in fact, make it unlikely that we will ever succeed, since we're doing this all alone and we're paying great costs. Under those circumstances, the choice may not be between staying the course and doing nothing, but between doing nothing and an alternative strategy, which is to lessen our visibility and thus our vulnerability inside Iraq while continuing the counterinsurgency.
And finally, there's no chance that they would turn it over to some kind of UN operation?
If we were right in the way we examined this administration's foreign policy, then indeed there is no chance. They don't believe in the UN. They don't believe in multilateralization. The only way in which they would ever do that is if they fully hand over the entire operation to the United Nations and wash their hands completely off an American presence. That, too, I don't think they're prepared to do at this stage.
And that was Ivo Dalder, who is the co-author, along with James Lindsay, of a book called America Unbound, an examination of the Bush administration's foreign policy. And I just like to listen to what members of the ruling class think sometimes, just let them talk. And that's what that was, and that's what the book is. A book published by the Brookings Institution, where Dalder is a fellow or something like that. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. Remember the Book Party Forum, Sweatshop USA tonight, Brecht Forum, 7:30 p.m., 122 West 27th Street. And also, you can hear this band, The Dishes, live at the Knitting Factory on Saturday night. The Dishes from Chicago. Let's go out with Got Something to Tell You from their new album, 3. Let me interrupt The Dishes for a second to say, please call the pledge line. The people were there for a few more minutes, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, or pledge on the web at WBAI.org. But please pick up your phone and help keep that wolf at bay, 212-209-2950. And let's go back and do more of The Dishes.